Thanks. Protocol feature map, which I renamed slightly. The program might say something like end-to-end. Thanks. I decided to re-spin it just a little bit. We had a really good discussion yesterday with the Samba team, David Cruzzi and I did. And there's this new piece of information on this slide that you might not notice right away, and that's the 3.0 that's after SMB. The original title of the presentation said SMB 2.2. And so I want to put in a little extra plug for SMB 3. And I decided to spin this a little differently from original. So what I originally expected to do was to talk about the kind of end-to-end picture of SMB 2.2, which would include the application scenarios that SMB 2.2 is intended to address, plus all the protocols around it. There's actually a bit of an ecosystem around it. There's a couple of side protocols and other dependencies. And I think those are pretty important, and they're still mentioned here, but I brought the message over a little bit. So here we go. I basically have 3 points. I want to bring you up to date on SMB 3.0, what it is, status, protocol changes that are in it, the differences from SMB 2.2 and 2.1. To kind of enumerate the SMB 3.0 features, you've heard it a bunch of times already, but I just want to put them down here. And then map those features to the protocol, right? My goal is to sort of break down the problem spaces that SMB 3 addresses in a way that a developer, for instance, might think about them, right? What do I need to do to address this part of the picture? And it breaks down rather cleanly. Some of them are big, but some of them are quite small. And I think that approach may help you, and it certainly is something that is helping me understand where we go with this as an ecosystem. So the feature set, it's remote file storage for server applications. That's what SMB 3.0 is. It's not about the file sharing protocol. That's not important. It's what the file sharing protocol enables end-to-end. And Hyper-V and SQL Server, the two Microsoft Premier applications, are the ones which we're most concerned with at Microsoft. But these virtualization and database type applications were never supported on SMB or file shares. Now they're the preferred solution for these things. They're fully supported in Windows Server 2012. And it's these features that created it, right? They needed availability, they needed multi-channel, they needed the performance and the availability story, basically, plus some application-specific support. And this is our short list of protocol-style features. And so you're going to see these features mirrored in a few places as I go forward here. SMB 3.0. Okay, SMB 2.2, the thing that we've been talking about since September, is now no longer. It's going to be 3.0 going forward. There's that blog there. It's kind of a mouthful of a URL. But that blog is a Microsoft marketing blog to talk about this. It is a rebranding. It is a marketing-style decision. But it's a very useful rebranding, in our opinion. Even as jaded developers, we like this. Because really, SMB 2.2, the protocol that we've been talking about, is truly a new major release. It's not a minor release. It enables a whole new ecosystem for SMB 2 and the applications. And we specifically, by renaming it, highlight this new server application support, right? This is a major change, right? This is the first time these applications use SMB. That's really big stuff. So we like the idea of rebranding it. You could argue whether 3.0 was enough of a name change. You know, that's the best you can do, bump the number. But, so be it. It's a number. There's no significant protocol change from what we've been talking about with SMB 2.2. So as a developer, there's really no reason to be afraid of this. There are some detailed changes, and I'll mention them in just a sec. But it's really a minor change. We've just changed a number and one operation. I'll show you that in a sec. And there is a preview available. It was published just a few days ago. Now, that is a real mouthful of a URL, but I suggest just searching for MSSMB-preview. That is a work in progress. It'll be published officially as the Microsoft publication crank turns. But it's complete for the SMB 3.0 changes, and it has other changes in flight for other work that's going on. SMB 3.0 is a superset, is a proper superset of SMB 2.x, which is to say 2.0 and 2.1. All its new behaviors are optional. They're client-initiated, and the client can choose whether to initiate them or not. And they're server-acknowledged, and the server can choose to support them or not. So they're basically offered by the client, on demand, by the application, and they're accepted by the server. Now, the client may or may not, or the application may or may not be happy with the result of the negotiation, if you will, but it is nonetheless optional behavior, each one of these things. And so that's what leads me to think about breaking it down, to presenting it as a set of things put together. Almost everything is negotiated. The encryption type is actually not, but that's a minor point. I'll show you at the end. The client's initiated, and the decision is therefore an application question. Do I need to support it? Is this important to me? Well, you have to answer the question from the application's perspective. You can't just say I'm the file server guy and it's easy for me to do feature X. You have to say, will that application want to use me if I don't support feature X, for instance, is a better question to ask. So here's the dialect negotiation. This is from the preview doc. It has a little joke in the lower right-hand corner. The joke will probably go away over time, but we like the joke in the meantime. It is three dialect. It shows the negotiation of three dialects, and this picture looked really, really different in an earlier version of SMB. We made it a little more complicated when we added the orange.
It's working, but it's not very bright.
Oh, okay. Well, then it's not very useful, I guess. I'll just hold the button. Okay, so the negotiation starts here. It has a couple of different ways to get to these states on the right, but SMB 2.0, SMB 2.1, and SMB 3.0 are the desired outcomes. And they're negotiated by both client and server. And the little dinosaur down there is our joke, the bigger, faster, scalier message, which we used at the SNEA SDC Plugfest last year, was sort of a theme to help bring out the bigger, faster, and higher scale capabilities of SMB 2.2. So they're present only in that bottom arrow. They're not present in the upper arrow. So we're just calling attention to that bottom arrow with our little dino joke. So now I just want to list the actual changes from 2.1. And I want to note, these are only a summary. This is a real high-level summary. I'm not going to show any detail. You can go look at the protocol document for all the detail. It may not even be complete. I don't guarantee that they're complete. But the goal is that to motivate their small number, it's a relatively small number for such a large set of functionalities that went into this protocol. So the negotiation changes, this is actually the most complicated one, or the one with the most new things in it. There's a new dialect number, 0x300, used to be 224, now it's 300. And the dialect array, the client offers an array of dialects that it supports, typically contains three entries now. The Windows clients all support 2.0, 2.1, and 3.0, so they offer all three dialects. And the server basically is, this client and server basically try to settle on the highest and best dialect that they both mutually support. There's a couple of little quirks in there. But in any case, they try to negotiate up. They do it in one round trip, however. The third bullet stanza is actually brand new. Clients never used to put capabilities in their negotiate request. They used to just put a zero in there. We've started to fill this in with 3.0. And basically, the client offers to the server all the things that he knows how to do. He can set all those bits. He can set none of those bits. It's his choice. And the server uses those to decide, how to set up, if you will, to handle the client and whether to accept the client or how to accept the client more accurately. On the bottom, the server capabilities, there are four new ones. Most of those ones on the top were actually already there for the server, but three of them at the top. The four at the bottom are also returned by the server. And so this is basically a negotiation of a feature-by-feature selection between client and server. And look at those things, because they're going to come out later. Multi-channel, persistent, direct releasing, and encryption. Those are the four new ones. The three on the top were already there, but they were never sent in the negotiate request. So this is just a little box showing the negotiate request bits and a little bit of description. You can see these when the slides are available. These are directly from the document. If you look at the preview, you can see the same thing. And the negotiate response, basically those same bits as listed. That's it for the negotiate operation. Next interesting operation, session setup. That's typically the second thing the client does. There's one new flag, session flag binding. It's used in support of multi-channel, and the request must be signed. It's basically a way to make a second connection or to reconnect an old connection to an existing session. Sessions persist now, and the binding flag basically connects to those objects. The reason they must be signed is that, well, connecting to a random session that might be forged is a, you know, dangerous operation. So signing guarantees that the same client is performing the operation. The session setup response includes a new flag, session flag encrypt data, that indicates that the server is capable of encryption. So encryption is done on a share-by-share basis, or possibly an entire server basis. So the client can use this to decide how to communicate with the server later. That's it for session setup. Two new bits. Simple as that. And there are the two new bits as they appear in the document. You notice how most of these sentences will start with something like, if the client implements the 3.0 dialect, or at the bottom, this flag. See the little dot, 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 I omitted some, but this one says this flag is only valid for the 3.0 dialect. So basically, these flags are qualified to the protocol version in use. The SMB2 header that is placed in front of every message after those, there's a new channel sequence in the async request header. It's used for multi-channel. It's also used for persistent handles. It's basically used to fence and check replayed operations, operations that are sent more than once, either because of a failure or various other reasons like persistent handles recovering them after a failure. There's also a new replay operation flag in the header and a create GUID identifier in the open. Those are in support of replay. There's a replay indication from the server called status file not available. That's pretty much a behavior, but it's protocol specified. So these are present in all messages. They basically track the sequence of messages as they arrive. So that's the only field that changed. That used to be called status, or reserved slash status. And in a request, that channel sequence comes in. In a reply, it still has the same function, status, that it used to have. Tree connect. The response adds two new share attributes, enable hash v2, that's for branch cache v2, and share flag encrypt data, that says that all accesses to the share must be encrypted. And the tree connect response also adds server capabilities. It never used to have any server capabilities. Now it adds the three new capabilities that are defined by SMB3, continuous availability, scale out, and cluster. I'll talk about those when we get to the end. So there's the response. And it just has two new flags and three new capabilities. Create, the SMB2 create operation. The new optional create context request, create request contexts. There are basically four new create contexts defined by SMB3. Request lease v2, which is an extension of the original request lease. Durable handle v2, which is a extension of the durable handle original that supports persistence and timer for the persistence. Durable handle reconnect v2, that's for recovering your persistent handle after a loss. And app instance ID, which is a special feature to support faster application failover. Talk about that in a sec. Create can request a lease on directories. That's one of the new behaviors of SMB3. So it's basically places where you might get a lease request that is new with SMB3, right? If the client is opening a directory, you may request a lease. The create response signals whether it's a reparse point. And the create response context, two of those contexts on top come back in the response to carry the result. I didn't dump out the create context because they're all kind of big and you can go look at the document. Read and write, there's only one change to read and write, and that's in support of RDMA. There's no change for read and write, but when in the RDMA mode, we use the channel info to carry a payload, which is used to describe the RDMA payload. Responses have no change. It's only in the requests. And when RDMA is used, there's an out-of-band, a transport level header called the SMB direct header that gets added. So that's prepended to the SMB2 header by the transport. So those three fields, one long word and two short words in each message, change their meaning. They change from reserved to having a meaning, basically, in SMB3 over an RDMA transport. And almost finally, maybe there's two more slides here. Ioctl and FSCTL. There are two new SMB-specific Ioctls. They're called FSCTLs, but they are handleless FSCTLs or ID-less FSCTLs. They're used between the SMB3 client and the SMB server to perform housekeeping tasks, if you will. The first one, validate negotiate info, is a new operation which protects against a man-in-the-middle negotiation downgrade. Basically, a middle box, an evil middle box in particular, could sit in the middle and, negotiate isn't signed, right? It's sent in the clear, unsigned. It says, I don't know what protocol you speak, please tell me. Well, somebody could intercept it and say, oh, he speaks SMB1. He doesn't even speak that nasty SMB2, and that gets him out of jail, right? And the man in the middle can do all kinds of neat things. So after a successful negotiate, it doesn't matter who he negotiated with, the client will send one of these FSCTL validate negotiate infos end-to-end in a signed transaction. And because it's a signed response, we actually know that the server on the other end produced it. If we don't get a response, well, obviously the server didn't produce it. Something else did, so we don't trust the connection at all. But we validate, using that response, we can validate that there was no downgrade of four aspects of the connection, the dialect, security mode, capabilities, and server ID. So we can verify that we actually connected to the server that we wanted, and it was the server that yielded these values. Okay, so it's an end-to-end validation. Very important for the security model. FSCTL query network interface info is used for multi-channel discovery. That's how we discover that the server has multiple interfaces. And it also has some bits on the interface that say what type of interface and how fast it is. So that's how we discover RDMA. The client actually doesn't know the server does RDMA until it connects to it over TCP. And then there are a couple of others. Get referrals EX, there's a new DFS feature called site name. It's used for some Microsoft facilities around direct access. It might be interesting to folks, but it's fully documented. That's a new Ioctl that's in the list. Offload, read, write, and trim are passed by SMB2 directly to the storage subsystem, used heavily by virtualization applications. So very popular. Consider supporting them. So that's the validate, negotiate info. It's a small thing. Basically, it has four fields. The important thing is that it was signed by the server. The network interface info that just dumps out these fields. You can see that there's an index, a capability, a link speed, an address, and the capabilities are basically RSS and RDMA. Can I accept multiple connections? Can I accept RDMA connections? Oh, and there's a new file system control. This is actually out of band of SMB2, but it's once again carried by SMB2. There's a sector info query supported by NTFS and other Windows file systems. This is very useful for storage alignment optimization. Hypervisors love this. They need it. They all pass through to the file system, and those are documented in those two documents, Microsoft documents. And the last big feature is encryption and signing. Signing and integrity, they kind of go together because of our choice of the algorithm. Encryption, signing, and integrity go together. We have a new signing algorithm, AES-CMEC 128, which is defined in RFC 4493. It's used by all SMB3.0 connections now. We basically changed the signing algorithm. The reason we did that was because it's more efficient than the old algorithm, and it's actually compatible with encryption when encryption is turned on. Right? The encryption will then provide both signing and encryption, both integrity and encryption, if we choose this. And so, By moving to a new algorithm, we can stick with one algorithm for both functions and gain more efficiency. The AES algorithm is highly optimized in hardware these days. Most of the CPUs have an AES instruction set, so this thing goes quite well. There's a per-session signing key. Optional encryption is done by AES 128 CCM. It's per-session encryption, and it has a key both for encryption and decryption that's different from the signing key. Okay, so we basically have three keys associated with each session when full encryption and integrity are turned on. You can enable encryption per share or for the whole server. That's kind of a Windows behavior. Another server could take a different approach, but the protocol defines those two atoms of encryption domain. It's interesting because it encrypts individual requests on a single connection. So a packet trace gets really interesting. You get one in the clear message and then one, you know, piece of Klingon poetry, and then another in the clear message, and it just goes back and forth depending on what share it's talking to if the server doesn't encrypt everything. So there's some interesting tools that we're doing in Windows to help that. And to do encryption, we paste this transform header on the front of the message. The transform header goes in the clear, and then the encrypted message follows it. So there's this little chunk of clear text that describes the encrypted text after it. It's extensible to multiple algorithms. There's a token in the header that says what algorithm was used to encrypt the blob that follows. But currently, we only define one type. So we don't negotiate the algorithm, but we express the algorithm. So we can extend it later. We can define a new field. And if you look at the, if you look at this, it's down here in the encryption algorithm field here. And then we just have this one entry possible for it. But basically, this is just a little header that goes in front of the encryption thing. It's like, you can think of it almost like a transport header for the encrypted payload. And a couple of miscellaneous things. There's a lease break v2 that adds the epoch. It matches the lease request v2. And multi-channel behavior is interesting in that it now defines a many-to-many association. The client will connect multiple times. And can you can have one session using multiple connections. It used to be you could have multiple connections servicing, multiple sessions being serviced by one connection. So we now have, instead of one to many or many to one, we have many to many. The policies by which these are chosen are basically the domain of the client. So the client decides when to connect and what sessions to bind to which connections. So that's the quick tour of the changes. Basically, that's the preview change bars from section 2, right? All the messages, all the protocol visible behaviors were those slides. That's pretty much it. It's perhaps surprisingly small. It is to me, at least. I hope it is slightly obvious to you. How do those things map, though? That's Captain Midnight and the secret decoder badge. Pivot from the protocol changes to SMB3 features. The marketing folks are talking about SMB in terms of these high-level application visible features. How do those map to this protocol, and where do you go? How can I help you motivate which things are easy, you know, low-hanging fruit? Which ones should I do first? Which ones are the most valuable? Which ones apply to the most scenarios? Which ones are the most valuable in the sense that they capture, you know, the killer application. So this is the little screenshot of the blog. High-level SMB 3.0 features. The next slide will show you. But basically, I stole the paragraphs out of this blog. So it starts off by saying SMB for server applications. And it says many of the features are specifically designed for server applications that store the data on file shares, blah, blah, blah. So this isn't something that you can answer in the protocol. This is something that you have to answer from the application's perspective. What does the application actually want from a file sharing protocol? What's it going to do? Does it want continuous availability? Does it want encryption? Does it want multi-channel? Does it want all these features that it might request as a file sharing aware application? And so we need to look to application profiles to answer this question. And really, all I want to say is watch this space. Microsoft is thinking about the profiles, defining profiles, or at least application behaviors, for the applications that we use over SMB3. It's been discussed at our PlugFests, and I hope to discuss it at the upcoming PlugFests in SDC some more. I don't have any information on it right now. But I'm very hopeful that we can give some really specific guidance for what features are critical. What features will the application refuse to work? What features will the application continue to work in a degraded mode, right? those kinds of questions. Second paragraph says, scale out, active file sharing with SMB scale out. Enables customers to scale share bandwidth by adding cluster nodes. Starts talking about clusters, clustered servers. So a couple of bits that we saw earlier suddenly light up, right? Which bits are useful? Well, there are three bits that are applicable to this area. They all mean slightly different things, and they all trigger slightly different client behaviors, but they're all closely related. Continuous availability, scale out, and cluster attributes of the server and of the share on the server. And a necessary prerequisite for using these things effectively is client and server persistent handle capability. If the client and server can't deal with persistent handles, then it's very difficult to have this same scale out and availability story. The persistence of the handles is what allows them to be sort of fungible, to be used after a failure or to be used across servers. And so the client, those two attributes are very important. And witness support becomes important. That's the first side protocol. I didn't mention witness before, but it is a RPC protocol defined by Windows Server 2012 that are in the SMB 3.0 family. Let me say that more generally because it's supported by other SKUs. In any event, witness is a failover protocol. It's basically a way for servers to tell clients to go to a different server node, a clustered server node in general. It can move clients around. It can tell clients about failover and give them alternatives very rapidly. When Thomas was giving his talk a few minutes ago, he mentioned 3-second failover. That was enabled by the witness protocol. Normally, that would take a full TCP timeout cycle to be detected, 20, 30 seconds. Multi-channel, third bullet of the blog. Fast data transfers and network fault tolerance with SMB multi-channel. So, given that it's stored on a share and it wants to go fast, well, it probably wants to go as fast as all the pipes can give it. And it probably wants to use those pipes in case one breaks. It has backup pipes online, active backup pipes online. This one's really simple. I mean, it's a complicated implementation, but it's very simple in terms of the protocol requirement. It's the server and client multi-channel capability attribute and the, network info FSCTL. And clients and servers or servers need a couple of interfaces. You have to have a multi-homed host, right? You don't want to necessarily do multi-channel between two single-homed hosts. But there are some interesting scenarios where one has one interface and one has two. Okay, you can connect to both interfaces. Even though you might be bandwidth limited, you have two interfaces that you can use, and there might be efficiencies at the receiver, for instance, with receive side scaling. So multi-channel is a nice little feature. And it's a very unique feature to file sharing protocols, which I hint, might want to consider. Here's another thing to consider about multi-channel, and that's SMB Direct, SMB 3.0 over RDMA. So scalable, fast, and efficient storage with SMB Direct. Trust me, it goes real fast. I'll show you in just a sec. In order to use RDMA, you have to do multi-channel, because that's how the client detects RDMA. And it starts with TCP. Performs that network interface query, finds that some of them are RDMA capable, and then starts speaking RDMA. You need the SMB Direct protocol, obviously, to do RDMA to SMB servers. Here's just a little thing about the advantage of RDMA, and Jim and Thomas mentioned this, and I piped up with 5.8 from the back of the room. Well, there's 5.8, that little yellow box right there. It's 5792. I hope you don't mind the round-off error. But these were, basically, this just went public a couple of days ago from the interop event. We have two workloads here, large IOs, half megabyte, and small IOs, 8K IOs. These are real IOs, not 512 byte IOs. But look at this. We're using basically the full wire for all three of these configurations. 1.1 gigabytes for 10 gigabit Ethernet. 3.8 gigabytes for InfiniBand QDR, and 5.8 gigabytes for InfiniBand FDR. And local is 5,800, the same number, right? Look, we're getting the same bandwidth from remote as we're getting locally. So we're actually not wire limited here. We're spindle limited. So that's pretty impressive. And look at the CPU. We're actually using less CPU on the client than we were doing locally on the server. That's another cool thing. Mostly because we cut the file system out of there, but also it bears, it bears witness to the fact that RDMA is low overhead. And then over here on the right is even more impressive. This is the transactional workload. This is the workload you can't lie about. And you notice that we're not wire limited here, but we're pushing 343,000 IOPS at a pretty good CPU rate with all these with these two RDMA fabrics. The local, it's definitely less than local. We're still working on that. But that's a very impressive remote. I'll bet you've never seen a single client over a single connection pulling 343,000 8K IOPS out of a server. Next item on the blog is failover, transparent failover and node fault tolerance. Remember the other one said network fault tolerance with SMB. So this is fault tolerance, which once again feeds back to continuous availability and cluster. Scale out is not here, right? Scale out was on the previous list. Scale out is actually applicable here. They usually kind of go together, but not always. Looking at the problem in different ways, you may choose to pay attention to one type of facility or the other. Client and server both require persistent handles to do this. The node fault tolerance is what this is all about. You may lose the connection. You may reconnect to another server. You may lose the lose all kinds of things, and the persistent handle will retain that state for you at the server while you reconnect, while you detect and reconnect. You need witness. Anytime you have a clustered server, witness comes in handy. And you also need, or optionally can use, the client and server application ID context. That application ID context is basically a registration of the client for its handles with an application ID. And if the application fails over, for instance, if you have an application running on a clustered server and the application migrates on a client node, then it can use that application ID to more quickly recover its handles. It won't conflict with itself if the server hasn't realized that the client failed over. It's kind of the flip side of witness, if you will. So that application ID is flowed over, over SMB. And that's actually a fairly lightweight thing to implement, by the way. Volume shadow copy snapshots is the next thing on the blog. VSS for SMB file shares. The VSS is the Windows words for volume shadow copy service. This requires a new protocol called the Remote VSS Protocol, our FSRVP. This is another one we've documented and talked about. I think we talked about it at SDC, and we've talked about it since. It's really interesting that there's no SMB3 requirement here. This is clearly a companion protocol, but there's no dependency on SMB3. This is a completely parallel thing. There's one tiny little dependency, though, that they both need to agree on. And that is that FSRVP, when it creates a snapshot, it exposes it as a share. And so there needs to be some coordination of what that share name is and how you connect to that share name. So the infrastructure needs to be thought through a little bit to deploy this. But this is a totally independent development effort, depending mostly on snapshots, file systems, and this new protocol, FSRVP. FSRVP is used heavily by Hyper-V, for instance. Encryption, secure, that's the second to last, I think. Secure data transfer with SMB encryption protects data in flight from eavesdropping and tampering. This is really great because SMB in general, also could never really carry high business impact data, right? Data couldn't be encrypted with the protocol, or at least not by standard means or convenient means. So now it's wired into the protocol. It's wired into it in a very thorough way. It goes all the way to the share. It protects data on the share. It can be controlled by the administrator. And it